Welcome to Learn to Live Stress-Free. This is Christine Wright with Dr. Robert Wright Jr., your go-to wellness coaches of www.stressfreenow.info. Our featured guest today is Dr. Joe Serio, an international speaker, trainer, and author who holds a PhD in criminal justice from Sam Houston State University with a specialization in leadership and organizational behavior. His career is highlighted by unique experiences in the former Soviet Union investigating the Russian mafia, including a year spent working in the Organized Crime Control Department of the Soviet National Police prior to the collapse of the USSR. Dr. Joe started his own company assisting foreign corporations in Russia and later became a consultant to the New York-based global corporate investigation and business intelligence firm Kroll Associates. Soon, he became the director of the Moscow office of Kroll, overseeing investigations across the former Soviet Union. While in Russia, he was also a consultant to major U.S. and European media companies and helped produce 3 documentaries for A&E's investigative report. Back in the U.S., Dr. Joe devoted much of his time to finishing his Ph.D. and traveling around the U.S. speaking to corporate audiences on business security issues in Russia. He also served as editor-in-chief of the well-regarded magazine Crime and Justice International and as co-instructor of week-long programs on developing effective relationships with the media. Dr. Joe is the author of the critically acclaimed book Investigating the Russian Mafia. The first of his 2 books in his Get the Nerve series are Overcoming Fear, 50 Lessons on Being Bold and Living the Dream, and Public Speaking, 50 Lessons on Presenting Without Losing Your Cool. Dr. Joe, welcome. Audience, welcome. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hi, Joe. Thank you for being our featured guest today. And audience, you are in for a treat with the wonderful Joe Serio here.
Hi, Bob.
Joe, would you tell us about yourself and what led you to the work that you're doing now?
Well, I think the easiest way to start, or the best place to start, is to talk about the fear factor. So I grew up on Long Island, outside New York City, the 9th of 12 kids. And, you know, it was kind of a typical household in that I had parents that were, you know, you got a 97 on the exam, what happened to the other 3 points? You know, this isn't right, this isn't good enough. And don't get me wrong, my parents were amazing. They were incredible providers, except I grew up with a fear of making mistakes, which is a fear I think an awful lot of people have. And that fear kind of led me, just kind of an interesting verb to use, it led me to do nothing, right? It led me to kind of, I had all kinds of things going on in my mind. I had guitar, music, foreign language, travel, writing books, writing for the school newspaper in high school, all those things I wanted to do. I didn't do any of them. And ultimately, when I started the current business I have, it was, how can I take that experience and what I learned over the last 30, 35 years and translate that for audiences so that they can figure out what is their fear, where it came from to some extent, but more importantly than that, what is it that they can do about it? What does it actually mean? And how can they wrestle it and make sense of it to take steps forward to go get what they want, to have the life that they want? Because, you know, that was my experience, my path. Was locked down in fear, paralyzed by fear, not really doing a fraction of the things that were bouncing around in my mind, and then over time realizing, coming to understand some of the principles, some of the realities of fear, which is essentially what we're going to talk about today.
Well, great, Joe. Thank you for that answer, and I think that's very interesting. Being number 9 of 12. So based on your experiences, Joe, can you tell our audience what the major underlying causes of fear are from your perspective?
You know, there are so many, and one major one is the gap between what we want the world to be and what we see it as, kind of this idea of expectations. So I've worked really hard, and this may sound a little counterintuitive to the audience, but I've worked really hard to minimize my expectations. And somebody may say, well, how do you run a business? How do you set goals if you don't have expectations? And the trick is, how can I set my goals without having highly detailed expectations so that if a situation doesn't come out the way I want it to, I'm going to be disappointed, you know? So I want to set myself up so that when I, how can we put this? So when I have a situation, if I create a highly detailed set of expectations in my mind and reality doesn't look like that, now I'm disappointed. Now I'm depressed. Now I'm fearful. Now I'm anxious. Now I have stress because the picture in my mind has not been translated into reality. So I think that's one of the areas, the broad areas of fear that people have to deal with is expectation. And then the more fundamental, which is very well known to your audience, is my fear of being embarrassed, my fear of people making fun of me, my fear of making mistakes. All those fears that we have that people dwell on or attach to serve to keep us in our comfort zone. And the funny thing about the comfort zone is that everything we want to do, the expectations, or I should say the nurturing, the growing, the experiences, the new experiences that we want to have, they all lie outside of our comfort zone. Except when we're locked down and worrying about making a mistake and what will people think of me and people will laugh at me, that keeps us inside our comfort zone, which serves to kind of stifle us and not really help us expand our wings, spread our wings, and become the people that we can become. If we go down one level, one layer deeper, what all that means is my fear really isn't of making a mistake. My fear really underneath that is people leaving me. If I make a mistake, I won't be good enough. People will leave me. If I embarrass myself, people will laugh at me. They won't want to be my friend and they'll leave me. Maybe I won't be able to survive if I'm not perfect in my parents' eyes. Maybe I won't be able to survive if I lose that job and I can't make any money. And that kind of fundamental fear, I think, boils down to just a couple of those things. Fear of being abandoned, fear of not surviving, fear of people who supposedly love you leaving you. I think that's what fear comes down to, ultimately.
Wow, Joe. I mean, I'm loving this. You've touched on the fear of the loss of love, fear of criticism, fear of humiliation, and all those things tie directly into the self-image and the sense of being deserving and worthiness. And so that I hope you'll also at some point talk about the fear of success, because I think that underlying those things is also where if you had gotten that 100% on that exam, then what? Because now there can't be the criticism of where's the other 3% that was missing. You hit that, but then the pressure becomes, can you hit the 100 every single time?
Right, and I'd love to share with you a quick little exercise, a quick little story that I share in my keynote speaking and in my trainings, illustrating exactly that point. So I have a glass, kind of the old style Coca-Cola glass that I bring to my speaking, and I have a handful of coins. And this is what we do, exactly what you were saying. We're trying to fill that glass. I have money, it could be anything that we're putting in the glass. And I throw some coins in the glass and say, I have to get 100 on the exam. I have to score a touchdown in the football game. I have to win a medal at the track meet. I have to, you know, and then I'll be worthy, and then I'll be acceptable, and the old man will give me a pat on the head, and when I fill the glass, everything will be wonderful, and everything will be perfect, and then I get 100 on the exam, and I realize when that happens, number one, the old man may or may not acknowledge it, and number two, I empty the glass and start all over again, just as you were suggesting. And now I have to get 100 on the next exam, and I have to score a touchdown in the next football game, and I have to get a medal in the next track meet. And the conclusion that we reach, and this is the conclusion that I reached on my path, the glass was always full. It was full from the day that I was born. And my illusion, based in fear, was that the glass was empty, or at least half empty, half full, however you want to look at it, right? But the glass was actually full in terms of my worthiness as a human being. And over time, what I had to sort out was, wait a second, these issues A, B, and C, those are my father's issues. These issues A, B, and C, those are my mother's issues. I need to make a distinction between what other people own and what I own, and what that stuff meant, and what is going on in my mind. And when I dissected it, I said, oh, my father was born in 1920 in Italy. My father was an immigrant. My father grew up in the Depression. My father had 12 kids, all these things that I couldn't possibly understand when I was 5 years old, 7 years old, 8 years old, at the time when I was creating my fear messages, at the time when I was creating the narrative of my life, there's no way I could make sense of them. So throughout my 20s and 30s, I had to start that process of understanding what happened. What happened 20 years ago? What was that about 25 years ago? And to come to the realization and the conclusion that I had the best parents in the world. No more discussion. You know, we're not talking about the negatives. We're not talking about what they did and what they didn't, what they did to me or what they didn't do for me. It's like, no. I had the best parents in the world. That's it. The rest is my life. The rest is my responsibility to sort it out and to become the person that I always was from the beginning when the glass was full.
Well, Joe, I want to thank you, and I have two responses which I believe our audience will relate to very well. One, when you mentioned the thing, I'm talking about emotional pain here, because I think that we can look at fear as a type of pain, right? Because when you're scared, it hurts. It's not fun. And so if we think about it like that, two things that came to mind when you were talking. Should you get the 100% on the test, which eliminates the question, what happened to the other 3%? I know our audience could clearly see, in Joe's household, he keeps getting 100, and he's got other siblings, 12 of you. Not all of them are getting 100. So all of a sudden, Joe, you're going to become maybe like a less likable because, you know, why can't you be smart like Joe? Why can't you, right? And so
exactly.
That creates a tension in the household. Then in your class and in your school, hey, there's that guy. He always gets 100. Let's get him, right?
right.
And then,
right.
So that's what I was thinking. And then the second part of that is, you know, you talk so much about your father and about about this thing, this 3%. And what I was thinking is that now Joe got the 100%. Now the person in our audience got the 100 on the test. They come home like a little puppy and they go, look, mommy, daddy, I got 100. I got an A+. I'm honors. And then, Joe, this is the part that I think that hurts the most. When they don't say, great job, oh, this is fantastic, you know what the mm-hmm. response is, Joe? Nothing. The nothing mm-hmm. response. That's what I call it. That can, so when you got the 97 it wasn't good enough. Now you got the 100, it's not good enough. So this is like, the between the rock and the hard place. And then, as you said, you're at developmental stages where you don't have the capacity to really grasp, what's being created here in terms of a gap, as you said.
Well, I agree with all of that. And I'll throw an additional kind of interesting and sadly funny another layer on top of that. My oldest brother is a priest. And my father would say, oh, I should have stopped after the first one.
My gosh.
What? So part of the answer to your comment is, yeah, you say, okay, you know what? I'm going to stake out the territory between 85 and 90. Because that keeps me from because it keeps me from getting kicked out of the house, but it means I don't have to suffer that pain of trying for a pat on the head, And like you said, I totally agree with that point you made at the beginning. Was this is about pain and fear and pain and anxiety and stress? I think are all very closely related. If they're not siblings, then at least they're close cousins. Because you can see it all the time. When you watch people, and my mother's the most frequent word that my mother used for me when I was growing up was aloof, because I was not a talker in the family. I was a watcher, and I observed what was going on among. And being the ninth, I could look up the ladder and I could see among all my older siblings and their relationships and their boyfriends and girlfriends and all the rest of it that was going on. I was watching. And, so I would, my sister's boyfriend would say something. My sister would start yelling at him. And I would just make a little note in the back of my head. Well, when he said that, she yelled. So note to self, don't say that to your future girlfriend. Just zillions and zillions of notes about behavior and the way people interact with each other. And so when you watch people temper, the need to control other people, all depression, all these things, those are pains. In my mind, the way I choose to look at it is that's pain, that's unresolved pain from an earlier period when they created belief systems and their narrative about themselves or with us. I mean, listen to the way I talk. I will talk all day long like this because I never spoke growing up. So I tend to speak a little bit faster now, because when you're in a dozen kids and you're vying for attention and trying to get a pat on the head and trying to talk and trying to get seconds at the dinner table and trying, all of those dynamics of growing up in a big house, it's like, I can't get a word in edgewise, And so I think a lot of it is rooted in that pain you mentioned. Why do we do the things we do as people, as individuals, as entrepreneurs, as spouses? What is it that we're trying for? And the way we express it, I think, can be very interesting to observe, because it reveals something going on below the surface. Why do I have to have a Mercedes when I only make $25,000 a year? Oh, well, I must show everyone that I am a hero. I have arrived. I am worth something. I'm successful. And all these other traps, just countless traps that we encounter in our lives. Well, in my opinion and in my reading and in my observation, it seems that we are trying to figure out how to express ourselves, but we haven't figured out who we are. See what I mean?
Yeah.
People, when you try to express yourself when you don't know who you are, when you try to express yourself when you haven't resolved that pain, when you try to express yourself and you don't even know it's coming from a source of pain and fear, it gets very muddled. It gets very confusing. And it's kind of, this idea of holding two or more thoughts in your brain at the same time. It's like, well, I've got to do this, but people are going to say that. So if they say that, then I'll do this. And if I wear these clothes, then I'll be accepted. And it carries on into every aspect of our lives. All this, one thing I talk about in my classes, in my keynote addresses and conferences, is the fact that all of this stuff is connected, right? Your weight, your exercise, your nutrition, your communication style, your time management, your fear, your pain, your narrative, the money you have, the money you don't have, the job you elect to have, the job you run away from, your ability to say no to people in order to go have what you want in life, your inability to say no to people so you don't get what you want in life. All of these things are connected. And when you start realizing that it's a system, and the system is based, in my mind, primarily on that foundation. It's the foundation of the things we're talking about. How do you perceive the fear? What do you think it says about you? How do you discount yourself? How much and how deeply and how frequently are you feeling that pain? It comes out. It comes out in ways sometimes you realize, and a lot of times it comes out in ways you don't realize.
Well, Joe, what you said is so heavy. It's so heavy. You know, I'm revealing my age using, I guess that's a worn phrase. You know, that was really heavy what you said, so I'm going to lighten it up. When you were talking, I was listening to you when you said you were talking fast, and I was thinking about all these juicy thoughts, and you have practical tips and solutions for people. And so I was going to bring in like Mel Brooks here, you know, from the Men in Tights movie. And then when the guy says, maybe if you say it in a funny way, then, you know, it won't sound so bad. So I was thinking is that in your case, maybe the fact that you didn't talk when you were younger and you just observed, you're like Phil Jackson on the basketball side. Phil Jackson was the sixth man. He sat on the bench when he was injured, and he observed, and he watched, and he was a scout. And then later, what happened? He became, you know, in my opinion, I think he's the best NBA coach ever. Now, I know I'm going to get in trouble for saying that. So, but in any event, that's what I heard you said. You know, because you observe, you now have all these things that you can say, and you're giving all this wise advice. So that's how I take it. And, of course, we all wish that you could have spoken when you were a kid. But, hey, look what you're doing now, right?
Let me tell you something very quickly, and maybe this serves to lighten it up a little bit. Here's the bottom line. I don't care, right? And I share that with my audience. I don't care. I don't care what you think about me. I don't care, he has a funny accent. He's from New York. You know, I don't care if you like my glasses. I don't care if you like my clothing. I just don't care. And I'm going to make mistakes. And what I figured out was, you know what? People aren't really thinking about me as much as I think they're thinking about me. People really,
no.
They don't care. People
are
don't
you
care
for
how
real,
my life
Joe? Come on.
No, come on. Are you kidding me? People don't care how my life turns out. Think about that. People will say, oh, Bob lost his job. Too bad. You want to go get a bagel? You know, whatever. It's like, okay, Bob, you got a problem. Good. It's good for you. We all have problems. Blah, blah, blah. And I spend half my life.
I want front row seats to your show, Joe. This is wonderful.
Wait, and you're already at Pantera Bread. You're already at the bagel place.
You know, but that's it. It's like, That's the thing, isn't it? I'm an awesome public speaker when I'm in a room alone.
Okay.
You know what I mean? The problem starts when there are people in front of me. And that's what we do. We give everybody our energy and our power. That's what we do. We give it away to people and say, oh, they're better than me. I can't possibly. Oh, they're smarter than me. I can't possibly. Oh, they're judging me. I can't possibly. To public speaking, I can't write a book, I can't step outside my comfort zone. And the major conclusion I came to, I don't care. I just don't care anymore because I'm tired of being tired. And the first half of my life was, wringing my hands, what if? You know, and it just serves to keep us locked down in place. But locked down in place is not where we're meant to be.
Joe, thank you. That is just really also beautiful, and I absolutely know. I realize I may be overstepping, but I'm just going to stick with it. I absolutely know our audience is enjoying this. You know, before the broadcast, you'd mentioned many times someone or a few people in your audience would say, I feel like you were talking just to me. Well, I'm experiencing that here. I think maybe all your years of observing and being aloof, so many of these wonderful ideas have germinated. You're really feeding them back to me and to Bob and to our audience so well. What resonated with me as I listened to you tell your story about being in your family, going through life, and this concern or focus that each of us might have at some time, you know, what will they think of me? How will they judge me? As a teacher in the classroom, so many times it happens in the family and in school, you get a gold star if you're good, you stand in the corner if you're bad. This constant judgment that we have in our life, it can easily fuel these fears. And I just enjoy your body of work on fear because, you know, we go through life, as you said, you enumerated, we're afraid of everything. It's, you know, it's not just the big dog. It's, will they like me? Am I wearing the right dress? Am I wearing the right suit? In your work and talking to audience in your own life and your experience with fear, you know, you've talked about many of them, but could you tell us something more about this, the fear of success and the conversations that we have and the internal resistance that some of us may have that keep us from accomplishing our goals? How do you address that? How do we address that?
Well, it's funny you mention that because I did a presentation yesterday and the mayor of the city was in the audience. And somebody, about 150, 200 people in the audience. And I asked the audience, tell me what you or tell me what people in general are afraid of. And the first answer out of his mouth and one other person in the audience, they both said it at exactly the same time. And they said success. And that's not an answer I get immediately most of the time. Because people assume, they say, well, if I had success, I would be happy. If I had X number of dollars, I would be happy, and that would reflect success. And if I had all these things, then I would be a success. But the fact of the matter is, success is one of the scariest things because now we put ourselves out in the open because that just intensifies the list that I was talking about earlier, right? So if I'm successful, let's take the mayor. We talked about this in the program yesterday. The mayor of the city, he becomes mayor. He's now opened himself up to media scrutiny, possibly looking terrible in front of his peers and family and friends, possibly even making an honest mistake and being reamed for it in public. He has to deal with the politics. He has to deal with problems and solving problems, you know, just the whole litany of things that somebody in a position like that has. Well, guess what? I have the same thing. And Bob alluded to it earlier. What if I was the kid in the family who got 100% all the time? What if I'm the kid in the family who becomes the only millionaire in the family? And now people in my own family, and this is not the case, I'm just using this as an illustration.
Oh, come on, Joe.
Okay, we'll get to that some other time. But if I'm the only millionaire and I'm walking down the street and I have my Mercedes and I have my suit and everyone else in the family is looking at me pointing fingers saying, oh, look at Joe, now he's better than us. And I've talked to a lot of people who have had that experience. And once they were successful, they got money, their relatives came out of the woodwork, and now all of a sudden we have all these, you know, ramifications that we didn't expect. So it's people that hold themselves back from success because they're worried about what might happen. And then there are people who get successful and don't know how to handle it. So let me use just a very quick example. Money, okay? That's one of the, if not the number one barometer, rightly or wrongly, for measuring success. Look at Allen Iverson, look at MC Hammer, look at all these people who had massive amounts of money.
You left out Mike Tyson.
Mike Tyson, there's a whole, you know, Nick Cage, and, you know, almost every lottery winner, every big lottery winner. You know, and the question is, what happened to all those people? And you may say to yourself, wow, if I had $30 million, I'd be happy, I'd be normal, I'd have all that money, I wouldn't spend it the way they would. And I just ask, well, how much do you make now? Well, I make $100,000. Okay, and what do you have? Well, I'm $50,000 in debt, and I buy cars that I can't afford. Yeah, it's exactly my point. Because money, success, doesn't define who we are. It magnifies who we are. Money magnifies who we are. And so when I had money for the first time in my life, it magnified who I was at that point in my life. I was 25, 27, making six figures and having all my expenses virtually taken care of. I had money, and it all went away because it magnified who I was at that point in my life. People are afraid of success for a lot of reasons. And the core are the things we mentioned earlier, you know, fear of mistakes, embarrassed, abandonment. I have to show people that I am somebody. Or if I get up to that point, that pinnacle of success, who's going to knock me off? What are the threats to me and my identity and my, you know, makeup if I reach that level of success? I don't know if I just went down the track you were. Did I answer?
That was wonderful what you said.
It was wonderful. And what I was thinking about, that I'm really pleased to hear that in an audience that large, that you had that question, that answer to the question about the biggest fear, because, you know, most people are familiar with the fear of failure, and you see a lot of that in literature, but there's very little comparatively about the fear of success. In the case where you were talking about the mayor, what I was thinking about is what your concept of expectation, where, okay, so besides all the things that you mentioned, now he's in that position, so now there's an expectation. Well, are you going to run for higher office and all the things that are involved with that? And so that creates pressure, right? And so in terms of the potential fear, what I like the most about what you said, Joe, is that success can be scary. So I think that figuring out how to take the mask off of that so that it's not scary, I think is really pointing in the right direction.
Joe, what I noticed with what you said, it's not that it's unreasonable. There are legitimate things that may happen, as you said, these ramifications of success. But you also said something before, I don't care. Are you living your life for you, or are you living it for someone else?
Yeah. One of the most powerful things that I come across, so what Bob just said about success and should I take this next job and go higher up the rungs of the ladder and all the rest of it, in the same breath with the Peter Principle, right? So there seems to be this urge or this pressure to rise, and at what point are you going to rise beyond your level of competency and set yourself up for quote-unquote failure or disappointment or failure to live up to expectations, all those possibilities. So one of the most powerful things I see is when I meet people who quote-unquote should be higher up the ladder, but they choose to stay where they are. So, for example, I work with a lot of police departments. I do a lot of training and speaking in police departments, fire departments, and government agencies. And I meet officers who say, yes, I'm a patrol officer. I've been a patrol officer for 35 years. And there's something, and maybe it's just my own defect, but there's something that my initial response is, you've been a patrol officer for 35 years. You've never taken an exam. You've never, what are you, a slacker? What are you, lazy? What are you, you know, all my old voice stuff kicks in. And then another piece of me, you know, we start talking and he says, no, you know what? I chose to stay here because here's the life I wanted to live. ... These were my expectations for myself. It affords me the opportunity to spend more time with my family. And I know that I don't belong at that level because of my quote-unquote objective analysis of myself, my talents, my skills, and my wants and desires. I love that when I meet people like that because they're not succumbing to pressure. They're not thinking that they have to be something that everyone else expects them to be. Because the fact of the matter is, we need people at all levels of the pyramid. We need great people at the base, patrol officers, line staff, whoever. We need great people in the middle. We need great people at the top. Which reminds me of one thing I'd like to share with you very quickly. A friend of mine wrote a wonderful book called The Book of Awakening. His name is Mark Nepo, N-E-P-O. Wonderful meditative reflection on his battle, just horrific battle with cancer. And he said something that's just always stuck in my mind. He said, power. There are two definitions of the word power. One definition is to be able, you know, kind of like we admire all these people, Michael Jordan and whoever, you know, athletes and celebrities, and they're so capable, they're so able, and they're so powerful. And he said the second definition of power is able to be. The first one is to be able, and the second one is able to be. Are you powerful enough to step into your space and be? To me, I think that in a lot of ways, it's far more difficult than the be able part.
Thank you, Joe. That's something that I think many of our audience can use just in their own self-examination. Now, in your book, you mention that so much of our fear comes from our failure to take 100% responsibility for our own choices. And I know that that can be a challenge for me at times. You know, it's so much easier to say, it wasn't me. It was, you know, the sky was blue that day. The sun was out. The cloud was out. Joe, can you explain more about what you mean by this? And what are ways that people can, you know, tools that they could use to take more responsibility for their actions and their choices?
Yeah, I think number one is the realization that everything in our lives, at least this is the way I look at it and interpret it and try to live it, is about the choices we make. You know, a lot of us have the yes, but reflex. Yes, I would have, but, like you said, the sun was too bright. You know, the clouds were too gray, and all these other factors that said, oh, I couldn't do it. I couldn't take responsibility for my situation. What are the choices? Are we aware and are we clear about the choices we make? And part of the problem when people start at that point and they say, well, I'm going to take responsibility for my life and I'll pay attention to the choices I'm making. Okay, that's not the starting point. A lot of people think that's the starting point when it comes to goals and choices and responsibility. So no, we have to do something before that. We have to decide what we believe. What is it I believe? What is it I value? What is it that is a priority for me? Because my choices are going to come out of that. My actions are going to come out of that. My behaviors are going to come out of that. If I believe I'm no good and the glass is empty, my choices will probably lead me to try to convince people that I'm worthy, you know, all that kind of stuff. And it goes from, for me, in my mind and the way I live my life, it encompasses everything. So, silly little example. My wife and I were burglarized a couple of years ago. So whenever I leave the house now, and I don't care where we're going, if we're leaving for a week or we're leaving for 10 minutes, I will take my laptop and hide it. Anywhere, somewhere in the house. And I will do it every single time. And even if I ask my wife, I say, honey, you know, I'm going out for meetings. Are you going to be here? And she'll say, yes, I will still hide my laptop. Why? Because if she decides to go for a walk, my laptop is not her responsibility. So I want to be responsible for my possessions. I want to be responsible for my words. I want to be responsible for my actions. I want to be responsible for my emotions. I want to be responsible for every aspect of my life. And for a long time, I wasn't. And that failure, inability, not even a failure, it was my inability to be responsible, to be 100% responsible for my life, grew out of this urge, this just craving to get people's attention, my craving to have someone pat me on the head and say, oh, your glass is full, you got 100% on the exam. And everybody needs that kind of thing. But for me, it was so warped because, you know, my parents had a philosophy of not praising us, really. My father in particular had a philosophy of not praising us for anything, period. So that thing you said earlier, Bob, about when Dad finally says, oh, I'm so proud of you, son. What a wonderful, that's fantastic. You got 100 on the exam. I never heard that, literally, ever in my life. So in my 20s and a little bit into my 30s, you know, my relationships were horrible because I wasn't taking responsibility, because I was searching for something else that was missing from 5 years old, 8 years old, 10 years old. So how can I take responsibility if I haven't even come to terms with me? So my, anyway, Bob, I'm sorry, I'm straying into heavy territory again. So let me get
well,
back.
Well, Joe,
we'll allow it.
This is just evidence that we're going to have to do a series, because the heavy territory you have steered into is in the twilight zone of existential grief. So we're going to hold you to that, Joe.
We really are so enjoying our conversation, Joe, and we're coming to the close of our time together here. I want to thank you for all the insights that you have shared in our conversation. And I want to use this as an opportunity for you to tell our audience how you work, how they might learn more about you, and how they might contact you.
Sure. My website is joeserio.com, J-O-E. S like Sam, E-R-I-O. And if your audience goes to the website, I have articles on fear, leadership, time management that they can download for free. And I have my Get the Nerve book series, which you're familiar with, on overcoming fear, public speaking, time management. We launched a specialized series for law enforcement on getting healthy, retiring well from law enforcement, and dealing with stress. Quite frankly, all of that information is universal, the way I look at it. So I think anyone would benefit from it.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you so much. So audience, again, check out what Joe is doing and the products and services that he has to offer on his website, which is joeserio.com. That's J-O-E, S as in Sam, E-R-I-O, and I do want to say that I thoroughly enjoy your videos.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Joe, what final thoughts or key idea would you like our audience to take away from today's broadcast about overcoming fear?
I think we have to, it sounds funny on its face, but I think we have to stop caring so much. And I think your audience knows how I mean that. You know, we need to be connected to the people we want to be connected to. And we need to be gentle and caring and everything else and kind with other people. But when it comes to the judgment and keeping yourself in your comfort zone because you're worried about what other people are thinking or saying about you, I think we need to care a little bit less about that.
Okay, wonderful, Joe. I think that's a great takeaway for our audience. So, Joe, I want to thank you again for being our featured guest today, and I want to thank our audience for listening.
Wherever you are, in whatever time zone you are in, we welcome and look forward to your comments about our show. Please contact us through our website with your feedback and suggestions. Remember, listeners, if you'd like to experience the same benefits our coaching clients get with us and learn how to get control of your schedule or easy ways to dissolve your chronic pain, stress, or anxiety, feel free to call us at 954-900-2179. Mention that you heard our Stress Free Now podcast show, and your first session is absolutely free. Call today to schedule your appointment. For Christine Wright, this is Dr. Robert Wright Jr. of www.stressfreenow.info. Until next time. be safe, and be well.